Every so often on this podcast, we do a book or a story that is markedly different from all the other ones. The last one I did that springs to mind might be by Chaz, My Cat Hates Me, the webcomic turned book that got translated by Gemma Stafford, who I don't think has translated anything that you could really cover on the show otherwise if you were doing a traditional book, that is. And this episode we're doing similarly, a little bit of an odd one out. Not an odd one out, but just a very different book. I was approached by the publisher, Columbia University Press, to ask if I'd like to speak to not just one of the translators, but also the author, which we have done on the show before. There are past episodes that have the author and the translator. They're often special ones. It was also striking that we had three translators on this one book, that you don't see that so often for contemporary work. I think you are more likely to see it in either a collection of short stories or something that's maybe been split between the time of various academics. If it's more like I just read one by a book by Qian Zhongshu, whose works in that, you know, in that translation have been divvied up between several academics. Anyway, waffling aside, the book for this episode is called Puppet Flower, a novel of 1867 Formosa. I took up Columbia University Press's offer to cover it on the show. It took me a while to get round to reading it, but then finally when I did, I actually really enjoyed it, but it was definitely very different from other stuff I've covered for the show. So excited to be talking about it today. So the author of the book is Chen Yao Chang, and the translator that we've got on for this one is Chen Dongrong. And just a heads up, if you're not so familiar with how names of Taiwanese people are sometimes romanized, if you're using your English language brain and you see Chen Dongrong's name, you'll see what looks like Tong Zheng or Tong Yung even, but it's Dongrong, and that's what you'll hear in the episode. So yeah, that one threw me off because I'm, like I said, I'm not so familiar with the, I don't know if it's Wade Giles or the, I know Taiwan has like another sort of slightly different but similar romanization system, whatever. I just thought I'd flag that if you're like me. So yeah, before we get on to that interview, we'll go on to the news segment, none other than the Chu Fic News, the translated Chinese fiction news. First news item, this is extremely exciting news, especially if you're living in the UK, especially if it's pretty much anywhere in England or a lot of Scotland, because chances are an event, a very interesting series of events will be happening, one of them will be happening somewhere near you. So what's going on is that Sinuous Books, friends of the pod, I think it's safe to say, are doing a roadshow, the Sinuous Roadshow 2023. They're going through, I'm counting 7 dates here. So it kicks off in Manchester. It's not quite a linear tour, but yeah, their first event is in Manchester. So I guess halfway up England at the Manchester China Institute. I'll be attending that one. Actually, I should say which authors they're taking first. So I think the topic of each event varies slightly, but essentially they're going on tour with an author of one of the books that they've put out in translation, The Sacred Clan, the author in question being Liang Hong, and then another author of another book they've recently published in translation, Liu Jianyun. So you can hear them talking. I guess all the events will be bilingual. I think different events will have different guests attending. So I'll be going along to the event in Manchester on the 10th of October at the Manchester China Institute, just as a guest, mind you, although you might see me helping out behind the Sinuous Books stall, so you could buy a book from me. By the way, before I list all these events, I should say there'll be a link in the show notes to a page on Sinuous website, which then has links to each of the events' Eventbrite page, which will tell you the time and the place that you can catch them. So yeah, 10th of October, Manchester, 11th of October, Leeds, at the much-beloved Leeds Centre for New Chinese Writing. On the 12th, they're at the Confucius Institute at Newcastle University in Newcastle. On the 13th of October, up in Edinburgh, they'll be doing an event at the Confucius Institute for Scotland. On the 16th of October, they're back down south at the London School of, what is it, the SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies. That's not a public-facing event, so you probably can't just show up at that one. But maybe you could try, if I didn't say that. The next event is on the 17th of October. It is in Oxford. Specifically, it's at the Oxford International Centre for Publishing / the Oxford Brookes Confucius Institute. I don't know if it's a two-parter, but you'll have a look on the event page. The you'll see the full info. And then the final event back in London again at the China Exchange. So you're not quite a linear tour, a little bit of north and south meandering, but it's a chance for you to catch these two offers whether you're in Scotland. You can probably get to Edinburgh from most of Scotland without too much trouble. The north, because we've got Leeds, Manchester, Newcastle if you're in the more far-flung north, the true north perhaps, and then down south you guys are of course spoiled, as you always are, because you've got London and Oxford events. So do check it out. It's a way to catch me as well. If you come to the Manchester and Leeds events, I'll be there. Just look for the hairy man in the maroon cardigan. That'll probably be me. Although I may not be wearing the cardigan. We'll just have to see. Okay, next thing we're covering in the Truchific News, it's actually another event. I won't be at this one, despite the fact it's happening in Manchester at an amazing venue. So it's happening on 15th of October. On the 15th of October, unfortunately, I'll be at a work event down near Birmingham, which if you live in England or the UK and you know Birmingham, I got the short end of the stick there. But yeah, anyway, this event, it's promoting the Book of Beijing. Two of the authors who've got stories in the Book of Beijing will be there. If you don't know the Book of Beijing, well, stay tuned because I will be covering it in a future episode. Spoilers. It's a collection of short stories translated, all set in Beijing or by Beijing authors. Basically, it's very similar to the Book of Shanghai I covered on the show in the past. And it's published by the excellent Comma Press, who are based in Manchester. The International Anthony Burgess Foundation or Centre, whatever, is a really cool building, great venue, worth showing up for that. And it's in a very central, easily accessible place in Manchester as well. So I'm quite gutted I can't make it to this one, to be honest, but I hope at least one listener to this pod shows up. Do it for the people. So the two authors who are going to be at this event are Gu Xia and Wen Jin. Gu Xia is a sci-fi writer, and Wen Jin, I guess, writes more sort of literary stuff. But yeah, it's there. Do go check it out. Okay, and last but not least, the third item on the Truchific News today. It's not event, it's another podcast episode. This is not exactly brand new. It went up 29th of August. I just happened to spot it recently. It's an episode from a pod called The Little Red Book. Or no, sorry, The Little Red Podcast, which covers all sorts of things China-related. I guess a lot of it tends to be the more popular highfalutin topics, history, politics, this big picture stuff. But they have dipped their toes into culture, because they're doing an episode, or they've done an episode basically just on Chinese sci-fi writ large. They've called it Cat Years in Cat Country, Sci-Fi in China. And their guest is... Have they got multiple guests? Yes, they've got two excellent guests. They've got Emily Jin, a sci-fi translator and sort of all-round sci-fi, Chinese sci-fi enthusiast, and another translator, Michael Berry. So both people with a bit of an academic background, but also people who know an awful lot about, I guess, sci-fi in general, but they're focused in the Chinese sci-fi context the most. So I haven't actually listened to this one myself. It's 52 minutes long, so it must be a fairly meaty chat, and the guests are great. So I think you've got nothing to lose, really, by checking that one out. Okay, and that is about all I've got to rattle off for the news today. I see we've not gone on more than 10 minutes. Very efficient of me. So, yep, now you just have the interview to enjoy. The main meat of the episode on Puppet Flower. So enjoy, and of course, if you have any thoughts on what you hear, you can always get in touch via social media. The various channels are in the show notes at the bottom, and you will hear me rattle it all off at the end of the episode as well. So on the show, we have Chen Yao Chang and Chen Dongrong. Really exciting to have you both here. So we have an author and a translator of a novel called, well, a book called The Puppet Flower, a novel of Formosa. I may have missed out a year in that title, but it's a really interesting, really unique piece of historical fiction, and I'm extremely excited to have you both here. So, hello both. What should the listeners know about each of you? And I'll put this question to Yao Chang first, since you're the author.
Yes, thank you. Well, I'm a medical doctor and specialized in hematology, that means blood disease, well, like leukemia or so. And I was trained in Rush Presbyterian St. Luke Hospital as a hematology fellowship during 1978 to 1981. And then I back to Taiwan and conducted successfully the first bone marrow transplant in 1983. And after working as a teacher and the doctors in National Taiwan University and the hospital, I retired in 2014. And well, that's my medical career. And besides that, I have been very interested to the history, especially the Taiwanese history. Well, it's interesting that in about year of 2000, I learned from my uncle that my first female ancestor in my family is a Dutch lady. And so I will get very ex I should say excited, and so I decided to write a book to describe the life in that Dutch area. That means about the 16 around 1650. And at that time, Taiwan, where we call Formosa at that time, there are three kinds of peoples. The first one is Taiwan, well, Formosa indigenous people called Xilaya, and then the immigrated Han people from Fukien, China, and the Dutch, well, that's actually is POC, and there's a businessman and the missionaries, and that's a very early and interesting era of Taiwan or Formosa. So my first book is Tale of Three Tribes in Formosa Era. I'm sorry, in Dutch Formosa.
In Dutch era.
Right. Amazing. I wanted to say, so although I do this podcast, and I am in my day job an editor, I don't do literary editing. I've ended up being my current job and my last one were sort of both have a medicine theme. The current one is editing basically educational materials for pharmacists in England. But before that, it was a like a trade magazine for pharmaceutical industry. And one of the responsibilities I had there was running an email newsletter all about cell and gene therapy. And although it was always the news, I did become very interested in the history of those kinds of advanced medicine. And yeah, I learned eventually it all a lot of it traced back to bone marrow transplants. So I think possibly when I first was notified about this book and your career, Yao-Chang, I saw that bone marrow stem cell transplants were involved, and I thought, "What? Wow, that is an interesting coincidence." And although I've since moved on from that job, it's just really amazing to hear that a quite important scientist, hope you don't mind the flattery, involved in that side of medicine is writing such interesting books. So great to have you here for that reason too. Dong Rong, how about you? How would What would you like the listeners to know about you?
Hello everyone. My name is Chen Dongrong, and thank you, Angus, for inviting me to join Dr. Chen Yao-Chang for this podcast. I'm one of the three translators of this book, Kui Lei Hua in Chinese. In English, of course, you just say the title is we use poppy flower. A novel of 1867 Formosa.
Right,
But
1867.
I was born. I let me introduce myself briefly. So maybe you and other listeners might be interested in my background. I was born and raised and educated in Taiwan. After teaching English in Taiwan for a number of years, I went to Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. To pursue my further studies. I study English and American Lit at MSU, and eventually I got my doctoral degrees there. So I went back to Taiwan to teach, to continue my teaching career. By the way, right now I'm in Melbourne, Australia. So that's why I say
Nice.
I went back, not instead of coming back. The university is National Central University in Zhongli, Taiwan. I'm wondering if you ever been to Taiwan or to that area. Not very far from the Taoyuan Airport, International Airport. There, I taught a number of courses to undergraduate students. For instance, Survey of American Lit, English novels translation, etc. And I also offer a postgraduate course, African American literature, to my graduate students. But my career have a change. In 1999, I was drafted by Taiwan's Ministry of Education, and I was posted to Canberra, Australia. Yeah, not to Canberra, and then cross-post to New York City to be education counselor in our representative offices. So there, so I worked overseas for a number of years, and then I retired from public service and went back to Taiwan to continue my teaching at a private university. Yeah. So basically, now I'm a retired, I'm retired. So I must admit that I'm not a professional literary translator. I'm just a translator on demand. At the request of Dr. Chen Yao-Chan, I get involved in this translation project of translating Kuei Lei Hua into English. I will introduce our team later at the later part. We have three translators. I have two colleagues to work together. So over these years, I did some translation as well, while in my spare time while I was teaching or doing administration job. I published a novel written by Toni Morrison. He's a Nobel laureate, Song of Solomon, into Chinese, and published in 2008. And so, yeah, basically, this is my brief introduction of myself. Thank you.
Cool. Does that mean that the two of you have a history as colleagues or friends? But since Yao Shang requested,
Yeah, we are friends for more than 30 years.
Oh wow, awesome! Well, great to have you both in the virtual room then. I'll move the conversation to the book. The next question, it's a very simple question, really, just five words, yet maybe difficult to answer because there are so many moving parts in the book. So the question is, what is the book all about? I guess an author always has to have an answer to this question. So I'll ask Yao Chang this one first.
Yeah,
What's
thank
Poppy
you.
Flower about?
Yeah, well, the name of this book also indicates that it happened in 1867, and in 1867, well, there is a episode, historical episode called the Robert Events, and because there is a American merchant ship called the Robert, and they have well. In March, well, they because there's typhoon, so the ship wrecked and all the sailors drifted to southern Taiwan. We call Kenting National Park, and they was killed, unfortunately, by the local Taiwan indigenous people. And therefore, the United States sent the Marine to that area to search that area to see if some people still alive. However, they was attacked by the local aborigines, and well, I'm fortunate. I was lucky to collect a newspaper published in August 24, 1867, the New York Herald, describing these events. And the title of the news was The Formosan Difficulty, and results official report of the fight between the crews of Hartford and Wyoming and the Formosan savages, particularly the deaths of Lieutenant Commander Mackenzie and the list of casualties. And so, because of this action, was now known as American Expedition of Formosa. And consequently, a diplomatic action was taken and results in, we are talking about. And the male protagonist of this book actually is a US consul at Amoy, and now chairman of Phuket. His name is Charles Legendre. And he actually was born in France and became American because he married with a lady in New York. And then he is actively participates in the
Civil War.
Then he joined the Union Army during the American Civil War, and he lost his right eye in the fighting with the Confederate Army. And his army superior, General Grant, later became the president of the United States, sent Legendre to Amoy Council for an easy job. But when the Dwarfish incident happened, Legendre traveled to Taiwan and to understand the situation. He got familiar with the island's unique status, and then he became expert about Formosa and Eastern Asia. The rubber incidents get international attention to the safety of the voyages in this area. Legendre chose to work with the chief of Skaro tribe, Tokitok, resulting in an agreement between the United States and the Taiwan Aborigines. And the first is in the oral form in October 1867, and then a written form in 1869. And curious readers can find the agreement content in the annual report of the US Department of State. And this is the first written agreement between Taiwan and foreign countries. And that's why I'm interested in this. And Legendre, actually, he later went to Japan and went to Korea. And he may not high rank in the diplomatic status, but his impact on East Asia, on the history of East Asia, including Taiwan, China, Japan, and Korea, is probably greater than any of the US president in 19th centuries. That's why I write this book, and I emphasize this role of Legendre.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's such an amazing little moment, or not little moment, such an amazing big moment in history that you picked out to turn into a novel, really. A thing that I was really struck by was just how many diverse, different groups, parties, whatever you could call them, appear. Because on this show, when I've been reading Chinese language literature, the majority of it has been from, you know, mainland China. And a lot of the historical fiction I've read, quite a lot of it has involved some kind of a Western or European colonial influence. And it's definitely hard to miss that in the mainland Chinese context, there's no one colonial power, like, say, Britain and India. You have lots of different interfering foreign powers. But then the people that they're colonizing, at least in all those stories, are more or less one big group, the Han Chinese. But in this novel, on the island, there's so many different groups because, like you said, the our guy, Legendre, my French isn't good, he's already got a American-French diversity, complexity to his background, and different Western powers are involved. But even if we remove all the Westerners, all the Americans, all the Europeans, the people of Taiwan are really diverse themselves because it's not just Han Chinese on one side, Aboriginal people on the other. There are lots of different groups and subgroups, and you've captured them all at such a micro level. That was a huge draw of the story for me, and it made it, at least in stuff I've read in translation, quite unique. I wonder if, for listeners who are not so familiar about Taiwan, if we could say something a little bit about the setting and why it's significant that it's the south of the island. Dong Rong, would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, you mentioned that in addition to those foreign expatriates, there may be diplomats or businessmen or trader, missionary, doctors, medical doctors, or customs officers. On the island, especially in southern Taiwan, Tainan Tainan, Kaohsiung, Dagao. Dagao is the formal name of Kaohsiung, the present day Kaohsiung. And then Langjiao is the Hengchun Peninsula. So this is where the main drop, the backdrop of this novel happened in that southern Taiwan area. There are also, in addition to those foreign expatriates, we have, in addition to Formosan Aboriginals, those indigenous peoples, raw savages, so-called raw savages or cooked savages. They are mountain Aboriginal people and also plains Aboriginal people. In the plain, people have settlers coming from Fujian or Guangdong, mostly from those two provinces. And Fujian, Guangdong immigrants or settlers, they have Hakka speaking people, and they also Minnan, Hollow, Hokkien speaking people. And they have their own settlement, they have their own villages, they have own communities, so they are led by head of the village, and etc. And in between there are Dusunzi. This is very special. This is culturally specific term in the novel. Hoseng is native born. It's the offspring of the intermarriage into the Hokkien settlers married plains Aboriginals ladies, so they get married, and then their offspring is Tusans. So their identity is a bit different in between. So just like the leading female character, Deme is a bit is not Tusans, but he is in between. So a lot of mixtures there, hybrid, ethnic communities in that. So they speak different languages within the small area, and different ethnic groups. But they communicate, they have conflict, but they also have working in harmonious relationships between Aboriginal landlord. Normally, those Hokkien immigrants have to tend their tenants to land, so they have to pay tribute to the leaders of the tribe, and etc. But later, you have army officers or government officials from mainland China post to Taiwan by the Qing Dynasty court and the Qing court in Beijing. And they are from different places, from Hunan or from Guangdong or from other places. So in that area, so it's very vibrant, very diverse group, people living in the same place. And they have conflicts, but they also have they have tensions, but they are working, trying to work together in order to survive. So this novel is very interesting to read. It's because it's so rich. I think I wanted just to say this to add it to Dr. Chen's explanation, and your explanation about Taiwan, yeah.
I'd like to keep talking about the setting and asking more questions about it, but I think we've got to keep moving. So I think more of the history
Yes.
will probably come up as we go. So I'm sure we can hit the various points, but I want to ask a question to Yao Chang. So you've told us a little bit that your career, I guess the first part of your career was as a doctor in science and biology, but you made a switch to writing historical fiction. But specifically in the case of this book, what motivated you to write it?
Yes, well. In my point of view, this Robert instance is very important in Taiwanese history and also even in the global history. However, the history of the Taiwan indigenous people was ne neglected because there is no written language for them. And And this Robert incident is so important because it has so-called butterfly effect. It begins with the Robert incidents in 1867, and then the Japanese invasion to Taiwan in 1874. And then finally, the Japanese occupation of Taiwan in 1895. And however, this Robert incident was little known by Taiwanese because in the Qing era, in that time in 19th centuries, the Qing Empire doesn't regard those areas of Taiwan Aboriginal people as its judicious area. So there's a very little document was left. And so the people doesn't know this. And I'm fortunate because I read Lysander's directory, and I just mentioned tribal note in Formosa. So, and it's a very detailed description about these robber events, how he came to Taiwan and how he went to see the Taiwan the officers in Qing Dynasty in Taiwan who. So I depict those major history branch in Lysander's books. And then for the indigenous part, I went to that area to visit many peoples, many elderly indigenous people, and ask them how their ancestors told him about this story. And but mostly they didn't know this story. That's, well, to my surprise. And so I write down this book. And also to emphasize that, as Dong Long says, I would like to make the Taiwanese people to know Taiwan has long been the fusion of several ethnic groups from 17th century in Dutch area. And there has been many ethnics in that time. So most of the Taiwanese has a paternal lineage of the Han Chinese, their maternal lineage actually is Formosa natives. And therefore, the most of the Taiwanese not only has Asian mainland Han blood, but also has Austronesian. That means Southern Pacific Islander blood. That's very amazing. And just as you said, that's not happened in mainland China and only in Taiwan.
What you were saying there made me think of something. This will sound a strange thing to bring up at first, but you'll see where I'm going. So recently, me and my girlfriend got a pet dog from a rescue center, and it's a mixed breed. She's a very beautiful dog, but we've got no idea what kinds of dog are in her. And lots of people have been suggesting that we do a dog DNA test, because I guess, I don't know about in Taiwan, but you know, a few years ago, these DNA tests for families were very popular. My mom did one because I think in Scottish history, through different periods, pardon me, through different periods, you also have a lot of different groups arriving on the island, mixing together. And of course, in the modern era, we have a whole different range of groups arriving on the island. So I know those sorts of things are popular in, I believe they're very popular in America. They're certainly a thing here in the UK. You know, you could find out if you're 10% Polish, or if your ancient ancestors were Picts or Vikings or Celts or whatever. But like in Taiwan, is this something people are generally interested in? Do they do these tests?
Do you know? Yes. Well, actually, I have another book that is the Islanders' DNA. Well, because I'm a hematologist, I'm doing bone marrow transplantation, so I'm familiar with those DNA assays. And I know that in the States, they come from 23andMe. And well, I mean, and in Taiwan, actually, some of my friends, they also went there and to have some DNA test. And it's amazing, it's mixing. Because, well, some people was taught to have a Vietnamese blood, but actually that's Vietnamese blood in Taiwan, we call Bai Ye. Well, that's another ethnic group, because the Hans in northern China, and Bai Ye is at southern China, southern to Changjiang, to Yangtze River. And so, because Hu Ken is originally belongs to Ye group, so they, after they immigrated to Taiwan. So the Taiwanese group, the Taiwanese Taiwanese inhabitants now actually has majorly three kinds of brothers. That is, one is Baiye, second is Han, and the third, as I told, is Austronesian. And there is a book published about 10 years ago, and they say that in Taiwan, in Taiwanese people, like, I mean, like who can immigrate and their offsprings, and they have about 60 to 80% of the people had these Austronesian genes.
Wow.
And yes, that's what I'm talking about. That's usually, I would like people to call me Baizang. Baizang just means bad people the Aborigines people call we as Baizang. That means bad people, but that's because Baizang actually is not exactly identical to Han people. It's a mixture of Han people and Austronesian people. Yeah.
Amazing.
Is that too complicated?
No, I get it. I actually have another question related to your motivation to write the book. I didn't think of this when I was writing the questions. I only thought of this now. Why did you choose to tell this part of history as fiction? Why not write a history book?
Oh, well, if I write a history book, nobody will buy it, because when they will buy a history scholar and not a history book by the medical professors. That's easy.
Fair enough. Okay, more questions. There are definitely more things I could ask about that, but I will just keep us moving. So since it's a fiction book, we can do all sorts of artistic things with fiction. So I wanted to ask what sort of mood and style the book goes for. Maybe we could give Dong Rong a turn first, though. So, like, Dong Rong, as a reader, what sort of a style did you feel was in the book? And I guess that could affect the translation as well. We do have questions about translation later, but that's a thing that, you know, obviously, from going from such different languages, style and mood are questions. So I haven't really asked a specific question there, but is there anything you feel you could say about the mood, the style, the tone of the book?
You know, Taiwan's indigenous writers, they have, you know, Dr. Chen is not a Taiwan indigenous writer. He's a writer, you know, a Han Chinese writer, writing about Taiwan's indigenous people. So unlike those, you know, native-born indigenous people, maybe their ancestors are Austronesians. So when they are writing, they are creating in the 1980s, they felt they have a strong desires to be different from, you know, traditional Chinese writer, using very elegant, very formal languages to express themselves. Of course, there are also some country staff writers, you know, they are emphasizing on the rural area, rural writers. But Taiwan indigenous writers, they emphasizing their authenticity. So they deliberately try to write in a hybrid style. So if you are not careful, then you might get the meaning wrong. So that's Taiwan indigenous writer. They start to write, they create, for instance, Xiamen, Nanpo An, etc. They want to affirm their identity as indigenous people. Whereas Dr. Chen, he is a writer very, very much interested in writing about Taiwan's stories, especially in the 19th century, those stories. And he did a lot of research into the old archives, and also have very on-site visits to excavate the evidence, etc. Normally, he spent a lot of time before he started to write. So basically, his work is a fiction based on strong historic evidences. So it's fictionalized history or history-based fiction. Very interesting. I really enjoy reading Dr. Chen's novel. He is not a typical indigenous writer writing deliberately in a hybrid style. His style is very clear. So the move or the style Dr. Chen is aiming for is he tried to communicate, you know, what he had learned, what he had loved, and what he had, you know, because he has so many people in Pindong, in other places, you know, they are indigenous people's leaders. So he already, and he was also very interested in reading the old archives, or those history book, etc. So this book is meant to create, recreate a historically faithful account of the people and their lifestyle in that era. So I think he has done a wonderful job, very successful in recreating that kind of aura, you know, in that particular period. And his style is realistic, so nothing fancy. No magic realism, nothing like that, postmodern or very magic fantasy, etc. Basically, he's writing is very elegant and very classical, and I think very formal languages, and creating the right mood for the right person. So I think I really enjoy reading his work, and it's almost encyclopedic in his scope, and then he also very in depth, and he also have very strong feeling toward the characters, either historical characters or the character he create, and he try to give them life, or make it very vivid, believable, and very acceptable, very logical. I really enjoy reading his work, and there are so many characters in his novel. So it's amazing that he could handle all these, so many details, so many data, so many figure characters. So I think he is very successful in making to give you a sense of time, a sense of place, and a very fitting aura and the atmosphere for the novel he create. Yeah, I think he's a wonderful writer. He's a natural, I should say. He's a medical doctor by training, but he writes so well and so touching. And I really enjoy his style. Nothing fancy or complicated or to surrealism or to quite but everything I think he arranges very harmoniously, you know, including all the elements into this. And so it's very rich. It's very rich, very sophisticated, and but yeah, showing very sophisticated. Yeah, that's my feeling of his style and mood. Yeah.
I could tell a lot of work had gone on beneath the surface to create the fine details of the surface, for sure.
That's right. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question about the characters, actually, because even if you have an encyclopedia worth of knowledge and data, to bring it all to life, you need some human, emotional, psychological elements.
Yes.
In the book, we've got a mixture of characters who are real historical figures and some who've been sort of created, I guess, to help tell the story. But I just wanted to ask Yao Chang, how did you go about creating those characters and bringing them to life? Yeah, was it a purely technical process, or was it in some ways creative as well?
Yes, let me answer in this way. Well, cultural conflict is often a topic for writing. It's a good topic. And in 19th century, the Homo sapiens natives, they encounter three big nations. I won't say empire, okay? Yeah, the first one is the United States in 1867, and then the Japanese, and then the Qing empires. and all ended in the fighting. And I would like to emphasize in this book that the Formosa natives have their own governing system and social systems. They are not without order and civilization, because in many dramas, they will say that those indigenous people actually is so-called uncivilized. I won't say that. In addition, just also to answer your question, that's why I won't just want to write the history. In addition, to add some drama, I arranged a love story between the gender and the Formosan beauty named the butterfly, a woman like a mist and also like a flower. And I used to, well, I used the fate of the butterfly as a metaphor for Taiwan's destiny. Well, that's actually I am very concerned, because Taiwan actually was colonized by Dutch and then by Qin dynasty, Qin Empire, and then by Japanese government. And after 45 is the mainland from from mainland China. Yeah, so that's I'm very concerned about this kind of psychological adaptation in those colony areas. And then, so I call this the Taiwanese destiny, and I'm happy to see that Taiwan now will become more democratic, and is also, has very good industry, especially in this chip industry.
Yeah, famously. I want to say to listeners, if you're listening to this episode and you've not listened to all the past ones, an interesting one to pair this episode with would be the episode I did with Nadia Ho on Bai Xinyong's Taipei People, Taipei Ren, because the cast of that book are almost entirely, I guess, the group that Yao Chang mentioned there, who came over after the Chinese Civil War. So these leaders and military figures, government figures from the defeated Republic of China, who have come over, and as Nadia basically explained to me in the episode, sort of, took over the island and became this new governing group. So there's, as Yao Chang was emphasizing, there's all these levels of history, all these different groups, and Taipei Ren, you get an interesting portrait of the nation, but it's only from their perspective, not really anyone else's. But then in this book, we have the perspective, diverse perspectives of all sorts of other groups, and they're all linked to the one island. So yeah, just wanted to highlight that one and say, for me as the host, it's nice to get all these different perspectives. It sort of links to my next question, which is just in general, how close we're sticking to real history. Because I guess an issue between the perfect story and a perfectly realistic depiction of human history is that human history isn't designed to follow an entertaining arc. It's sort of random. Whereas usually in a novel, we need to make sure the reader keeps reading. We got to keep the plot moving. So I probably will ask Yao Chang again, did you stick 100% to the real history? Did you speed some things up, slow some things down? Aside from adding characters, did you have to change much?
Well, actually, I told that I keep the skeleton of the history, but the side, like the man-to-man or group-to-group interaction, I have created some stories. And that's why I create the actress, the female character of butterfly. And actually, when I say flower means beauty, and means that is a metaphor of butterfly. So, but I mentioned in my book, I said that besides butterfly, most of the history, most of the books, I the details I write is according to the books. So it's very close, but not 100%, of course. And I add some romantic figures and some conflict. Most of the conflict are true, but some conflict actually is imaginary.
Right. Fantastic. I thought I can throw another question to Dong Rong, since this is a good question for a reader. It's, do you have any favorite moments or episodes in the book? or indeed favorite characters? Because I think we've established on wrong that you like the book, but what are your favorite bits?
Well, there are so many moments of episodes I really like and which really touched me. For instance, while I was reading the scene describing Honor's Lin escorting Matsuka, the princess of a Paiwan tribe, I think that's very tight. Very touching, you know. It's a royal family, Matsuka, and this merchant from the plain, and tried to court to this lady, and eventually she eloped, you know, and without the blessings of her family, and they settled down and to start a family in Tongliangbu. And those scenes, it's very simple, but very touching, just like, because Honest Lim is actually is a poor immigrant, Hakka immigrant from Fujian. His father of the main character, Wen Jie, Wang Kite, and Butterfly. So the scene after his death, you know, tragic death, and the Mia, their then lord, tried to bring Butterfly and her brother to go down to the Siliao, yeah, to deep that kind of farewell. No, scenes is also very touching. They try to combine, you know, Aboriginal ritual as well as the Han Chinese ritual of burial, etc. But my favorite episode is related to the interaction between Tokido and La Junta, these two, you know, U.S. consul to Amoy and the leader of these confederations of the southern those indigenous people. Their relation, I think most of them are heroes, you know. Mm. They are good strategists and diplomats, and they know how to engage, negotiate, compromise, and make resolute decisions. And they so-called yingxiong xi yingxiong, heroes like heroes. They have the kind of mutual connection. They know how to protect the interests of the people they represent. So there's mutual respect and genuine admiration and true friendship between them. I think Dr. Chen Yaochang did a wonderful job to depict, you know, this kind of very delicate, subtle relationship between people from the USA or France and the inborn and native-born leader of Taiwan's Formosan indigenous people. So this kind, I really enjoyed Dr. Chen's description of before they meet, they have to make careful preparation and sensible negotiation, and eventually they have an ultimate decision to make to reach an oral agreement first, and then a written treaty between both sides to protect the safety of those seafarers, those sailors around the island, you know, just in case there's a shipwreck or a typhoon, how the kind of tragic event like the in the beginning, the kind of rover incident. So they try to avoid that. I really enjoy reading these moments. I think Dr. Chen Yaochang did a wonderful job. And in the novel, they have a turtle nose mountain. Now it's Da Jian Shi San. So it's the sacred place for indigenous people who live in that area. And before they meet, they have to go there and pray their ancestral spirits. So all this is very, Dr. Chen did a wonderful job to make the meeting and their negotiation. It's very touching. I really enjoy that moment, that part he described. Before, on the day when they meet, before they met, their lyrical description, maybe I can read just a few sentences.
Oh, please,
the October morning was sunny and warm, etc. So, yeah, I think maybe our listeners, they didn't get the chance to read Dr. Chen's novel yet. So I would love to read very lyrical description of the day when these both heroes, you know, Tokido and La Gionda, the council La Gionda, they meet. The October morning was sunny and warm. Gray-faced buzzards flew across the sky, clamoring at the ground below. People in Sekulu loved these birds and saw them as a positive augury. There were so many circling above, it was a spectacular sight. On this very day, when Big Head Chief, that means Tokido, was to hold a peace talk, luck was surely on their side. The shaman danced and chanted to invite ancestral blessings. People chant with her and the birds' calls continue. The shaman said that the calling revealed the approval of the tribe's ancestral spirit. It was the greatest auspicious sign, etc. Tokido sat on a sedan chair borne by four men. Several Sekulu warriors served as the front lead. They were followed by warrior in chief from the 18 tribes. Before long, they reached Volcano. This is where La Gionda and Tokido meet for the peace talk. You want me to continue to say something? That's enough. Yeah, I think I just want to share my favorite moment. There are quite a few. I really enjoy reading Dr. Chen's novel in Chinese. And later now we have the English translation. Very fortunately, yeah, we come up with this English language version. So maybe people, all the English speaking people, they can read and enjoy Dr. Chen's novel. It's really very good. Strongly recommend it.
And I should take the moment to say the publisher of the translation is Columbia University Press. So readers, you can order it from their website, a physical copy or as an ebook. I don't know if they ship from that website to outside the US, but I'm sure it'll be available internationally through other online bookstores. So yeah, if it's catching your interest, go read it. I wanted to say, to agree with Dong Rong, that I also really like the scenes where we have Le Gondre and the tribal leaders negotiating, because the depiction of the Aboriginal leaders and their military maneuvers as well, all of their decisions are very rational. So the way that the depiction I got was that okay, the Indigenous people don't have all the modern technologies and tools that maybe the Hakka, the Hokkien, the Europeans have, but their decision-making is pragmatic, rational. Mm-hmm. It's always what's in their best interests. Even if it's a violent response, it makes sense in the context. So the rover incident that kicks everything off when they see Europeans wash up on the shore, they're the last time they've seen Europeans, red hairs, they call them, their people were massacred. So perhaps this one time they do something that's overboard. They charge in and wipe out the invaders, but there's a reasoning for it. And then subsequently, they've sort of realized that was overplaying, let's say. So yeah, every decision becomes, whether it's aggressive, whether it's mediated, whether it's a concession, whether it's friendly, whether it's other unfriendly, none of it is following a stereotype of like a irrational, uncivilized savage. It all perfectly makes sense. And even if it's in contest with the American guy we're following, it's a perfectly sort of, it's what a professional diplomat would be doing, pursuing their interests and trying to reach an agreement. And maybe novel where we try, where the characters rationally try to reach an agreement, isn't the most exciting tale of battle and war, but that's maybe the mm-hmm. book's strength, that it's a more sort of measured, realistic depiction of real events. And it's still engaging. And yeah, the characters in those scenes on both sides come across as pretty likable. And I think the interesting thing about de Gondre is he does do some awful stuff in the book. And we learn, I think it's in the, I forget if it's in the foreword or the afterword, but we learn that he became, I guess he later in his life became involved in aiding
yes.
the Japanese colonization of
yes.
Korea and Taiwan.
Yes.
So I think it's, we can probably fairly say he joined the bad guys of history later. So he's not some simple good guy figure. He's just sort of, we understand who he is. We see he has a lot of abilities and he's quite sympathetic. But yeah, just because someone has great abilities, good problem solving, and can protect their own interests doesn't mean they're some angel.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really appreciated yeah. that side of the book.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought I could move us along. Loads more I'd like to say. But since this is the translated Chinese fiction podcast, I should probably ask a bit about the translation. So I'll give this question first to Dong Rong. But Yao Chang, please do chip in if you like, because I know you were involved in creating this English version too. Did translating Puppet Flower present any particular technical challenges? So Dong Rong, I'll throw it to you first, but this could be one for both of you.
Okay. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to explain the story of how we are carrying on this translation project. Yeah. So originally, I must say that Puppet Flower is a long historical novel. So to translate it is not an easy job. It does pose a lot of challenges to translators. You know? So I want to explain how we have a translation team and to get this done and eventually get it published. So the Chinese version is 460 pages long. It's a thick book. So many characters, as we just discussed, so many. They are native born Formosan Aboriginals, and they are also outsiders, you know, coming from outside to this island. So immigrants, settlers, sojourners from other countries or regions. For instance, we have the Qing government officials, you know, and military personnel post to Taiwan, you know, for different reasons, mainly to protect the interests of the Qing Empire. We also have, you know, Han Chinese immigrant, legal or illegal. They sometimes smuggle themselves to that Langjiao, the lower part of peninsula from Fujian and Guangdong. And of course, there are foreign expatriates. You know, you have Dr. Mason, James Maxwell, and etc. All this from different parts of the world, Scotland and England. So most of these characters are just as you just mentioned, are based on historic figures, but a few created by Dr. Chen. I think they are legitimate, you know, out of his imagination. Dr. Chen created the main, you know, butterfly, and also Song Zai, and also the temple manager, Mr. Chen, the illegitimate son of a very famous government official, Yao Ying, all this. So to translate such a long novel with so rich texture into English is a big challenge for us. For us, I mean that we have three in our translation team. We are responsible for this translation project. And our mission, of course, is to get it done within a time limit and get it published hopefully by a famous or well-known press. And fortunately, we get accepted by the Columbia University Press. So as far as I know, the project started in 18, right? Yeah. So yeah. You first commissioned Dr. Xu to do the translation to translate a novel into English. And she is a veteran translator. So I think it took her about 1 year to finish it, to finish the draft. And then later, Dr. Chen in 2019, he invited Mr. Ian Maxwell to join to proofread, edit, and polish the draft of the first draft. And in the meantime, Dr. Chen also asked me to help. So that's why I joined in and became the part of the translation team. And eventually we get it prepared, and thus we submit the manuscript to Columbia English Press. So my job in the book is to proofread and do a bit editing and compile a list of principal character and a bilingual glossary to help readers. Now, to this is my job. Actually, this kind of practice is also similar to some translation company. They would hire three people: first translator, and then reader, and then native speaker, and to do that, and later a one to compile. So my job is to help Dr. Chance to do that. But there's ch challenges as well. I must say that we have to meet how to meet the needs and expectation of different target readers, and how to understand correctly the difficult subject in the original text, and how to decide the role we should play, a mediator between author and reader, or a carrier of intercultural communication, and how to choose effective strategies for translation, and how to later, how to transliterate the proper names, in this lengthy novel, so many characters, and how to translate those culturally specific terms. All these are challenges for us, for three of us as a team. We have to tackle all these challenges.
So you mentioned there were some cultural terms that were hard to sort of translate. Can
Yes.
you recall any of those off the top of your head?
I think I just mentioned Gusenzai is one of the term, So when it was first translated, it was translated as born here as a noun. It's true, but it's a native born, but is it born here as a noun? It's a bit weird. So later, after discussion with Dr. Chen, we change it into, because Legenda translated into half breeds. I think he has his own, Legenda has his own way of translating this term, Tusenzai.
Actually, this term should be pronounced into from Hokkien dialect, from Taiwan dialect. It's Tosenya. Tosenya just means that's born here.
That's a
born
culturally
here.
specific term. It's difficult for us to, and but as translator, I must say that Dr. Chen is so well read. So he's a Renaissance man, a man of so many talents, so of great learning. So in this book, it is really difficult to get everything, every detail right. It's a big challenge for we translators, for us translators. So this book is based on his in-depth research, as well as field trips. He made so many field trips to southern part, to make sure every detail is correct. How long does it take to travel from one place to another? So it's fiction, but it's history-based fiction. It's fictionalized history as well as history-based fiction. So this Dr. Chen has quite an ambition to make this work. And eventually, I think it's he is successful to make people interested in reading this period of history, about this part of history. So Dr. Chen mentioned that the book Notes of Travel in Formosa by Charles LeJeune is very influential to him, because in that book he found much inspiration and also many valuable details. You mentioned cultural specific terms. They have some terms. Dr. Chen is not an indigenous people. He is Han people writing about indigenous people. So he doesn't write in a hybrid style. He doesn't mix, standard Chinese with Austronesian languages. But he also learned a lot of key words, which he think is very important to this novel. For instance, Ina, Kama, Bailang, and also Nana, Wuvu. All these culturally specific terms, they are tribal language, borrowing from tribal language. But fortunately, Dr. Chen always put footnote to help readers to understand them. So when we were translating, it was not that difficult, because with that footnotes that help us a lot. And Dr. Chen is very approachable, very congenial. So very fortunate for us to approach him whenever we have questions. So as translators, we are lucky. We are very fortunate to have, the author as a friend, as, very close by, very approachable. And he often offer us the correct answers. If he has doubts, he always asks, he has so many friends, indigenous people, writers, or authors, or professors. For instance, Dr. Ye Shenbao is the person he often consult, and normally that's why we can avoid many gross mistakes when we were translating this novel. And this novel is difficult to translate because there are so many classical Chinese passages there. For instance, Liu Mingdeng's inscription on the stone erected in the Fu'an Temple in Cheng. I think the language is very difficult. Even the last line is his title, about the day and his title is so long. So it's very difficult to translate. But eventually we conquer it because we are considering the readership. Maybe they are not as familiar with us as we are with those Chinese inscriptions on the stone. So for instance, the title in this inscription of Liu Mingdeng is Ti Du Qi Men Tai Peng Sui Lu Gua Yin Zong Zhen Fei Ling A Ba Tu Lu Liu Mingdeng Tong Suan. It's so long a title. It's an honorific. It's a long title. So we translators have to face this and to make, eventually we just to simplify it, regional commander of Taiwan and Penghu. Yeah. So the title of those officials and those officers are difficult to translate. Sometimes Fu Jiang could be translated into vice general. It's not correct. Yeah, it's not correct. But anyway, I will stop here. You mentioned that culturally specific terms. I will mention Tang San. Do you know Tang San? It shouldn't be just Romanized Tang San. Should be men in China from Tang San. But the first translator make it Tang San. Sometimes it doesn't make really sense to people, readers who are not familiar with this term. So I think as editor, I'm the last one to do the last editing, to give the finishing touch to the draft, to the version. So I am responsible for this accuracy of all this term. So Fujiang is not vice general, it's regional vice commander. I'm wondering if Angus have ever seen the TVC miniseries drama about this book. This Kuei Lei Hua was adapted into TV, television, miniseries, and it's very popular, but also create a lot of debates or controversies in media, but very interesting. But the subtitles of the miniseries, they have mistakes, just like they don't know the exact meaning of those specific term, the military ranks. So should be regional vice commander. Zongbing should be the regional
Right.
commander, not just commander of all the Qing troops, et cetera. So culturally specific, I want to mention others, but for the time being, I think I'll stop here. I talk too much.
That's okay. That was really interesting.
Okay.
I did notice there was a TV adaptation. I wasn't sure if it would have English subs, but it sounds like they do, even if
Yes,
they're not
they have
perfect.
English
Amazing.
subtitles. Yeah,
All
they
right,
have English subtitles.
I will put a link to that in the show notes then so the listeners can find it. I actually wanted to ask you as well, Yajang,
Yes.
how were you involved in the translation? I guess we learned you are, but could you talk a bit about your role there?
My role in translation? Well,
Yeah.
actually, I would say my role facing the challenges from the people. This is there's some, well, some controversies when it is adapted into the TV series, and
Right.
also some, but I also face the challenge that's well, as a non-indigenous writer, well, how dare you to write this this fiction well on the viewpoint of the indigenous peoples. But I would like to say it, I had to deny, but because I tried my best, and the reactions from the indigenous Taiwanese is not bad actually, and because I wrote the things about their ancestors, they didn't realize to know about it, about actually or knew about knew very little about this. That's very interesting because this story happens about 160 years ago, but because Taiwan indigenous people, they don't have the written language or written characters, so many of them they don't have the memory. So when I well publish this book, and they are very surprised. That's well, they didn't know the ancestor had this, I should say, glory moment. And that's I say glory is that because they represent the whole Taiwan to sign a agreement with the American representatives. I think that's a glory moment of their history. So they are happy about this.
Yeah, I suppose it's a conversation a lot of authors could potentially run into if you choose to make the well, if you choose to write from the perspective of someone other than yourself. I think there's a certain line of thinking that says you should never do that. You shouldn't write the other because you will do it disrespectfully. And there's maybe the opposite, absolute opposite of that point of view, which would say something like, as a writer, you have total freedom to do whatever you want. And my feeling is that the right sort of in between is if an author wants to cover or even write from the perspective of someone other from themselves, yes, they should have the freedom to do it, but there's responsibilities. Like you have to do it right. And maybe as well, it helps if you have a good motivation to begin with. And we talked about what your motivation was. We could see that you made a real effort to learn the history and a bit about the context that these indigenous people lived in. So I'm not surprised that you had some good reactions. That's great. But I can also understand why indigenous people might raise their eyebrows and want to ask a few questions because it must be a very sensitive sort of area. I think that's all my questions about the translation. So we can take things into lighter territory, the miscellaneous section. So speaking of, I meant to say, speaking of writing other cultures, I mean, I've been running this podcast on the literature of another culture for years now, and I still am not fluent in the language. And I just try to have the philosophy of, you know, don't be afraid to discuss someone else's culture, but also don't be an asshole while you're doing it. Try to do it respectfully. And if you don't know something, don't pretend that you know it. That's sort of my philosophy. But yeah, on the topic of the Chinese language, for every episode, we try to pick a Chinese word of the day that sort of captures the spirit of the book. So I was wondering if either of you, Dongrong or Yao Chang, can think of a Chinese word that fits this book really well.
Well, I think this Dongrong answer this.
I would choose Zhen, truth, because Dr. Chen Yao Chang is in search of the truth, historical truth. And now we try to, in Taiwan, people, we try to correct the mistakes and to find out the real truth. Yeah, I'll use this word, yeah.
Oh, so is this just Zhen, Zhen?
Zhen,
yeah.
Huh. Okay, Zhen. Easy one, yeah. I know that one.
Okay,
I've typed that into my document. That's okay. Great.
Well,
that's, I'd never thought of that word as having its own sort of meaning, being like truth. I've always heard it or used it as an adjective, you know, like gender ma, or using it really, you know, gender haoshi or something. But it's surprising to know that it can have this big, deep meaning on its own. But
yeah, historic truth. Yeah, historic.
Well, let me have my answer. Actually, I have no suggestion about the Chinese words, but I have English words.
Oh, okay.
Yes, the English word is Formosa. Well, right. You know, when you say Formosa, it indicates that Taiwan or Formosa is not a part of traditional. It's not a part of tradition, not traditional part of China, because since it was called Formosa first, and then Taiwan was called Formosa in mid 16th centuries when the Dutch people come there, and then it's called Taiwan to be called after Qing Empire took over Taiwan. So when you say Formosa, that means that just means the history of Taiwan is not started from the rule of China. Yeah.
That's a great choice. Does that mean it's technically a Dutch word of the day rather than English word of the day? Or am I being too picky there?
Yeah. And it's Portuguese. Interesting because
it's Portuguese.
Yeah, it's Portuguese. Yeah. But it's
Ila Formosa.
And it's very well coincidence that this year is 2024, and by next year, this year is 2023. So by next year, 2024, will be 400 year anniversary. That's the Dutch people come to this island, and this island became a part of the global history. And so that's it's the meaning of the Formosa is because Taiwan started from Formosa.
Right. 100-year anniversary. Amazing. I have nothing much else to say about the word of the day, but those were both great ones. I don't think we'd done an English word of the day before, but it feels very appropriate somehow for this episode. So that's great. The next question, it is one of these silly miscellaneous questions, but I think it's probably one of the hardest ones. It's this, if you could pair a piece of music with the book, what would it be? So for example, if we were trying to think of something for the soundtrack or the introduction music of the TV show, if we're making the TV show, what would it be? Do you guys have answers ready?
Yeah. Well, I have a joke about this question. Yeah. you know, Puppy Flower was adapted into TV series and then they changed the name into Scarlet. Well, and recently, you know the very famous music in the movie The Graduate? Well, the song is "Are You Going to Scarborough Fair?" by by Simon and Garfunkel, right? Yeah, and it's called the first one. Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, say Rosemary and Thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. He was a true love of mine. And recently, I saw some people translate this, the name of this son. Are you going to Scarborough? And it was translated into Niaochi Sukaroma. That means they use the name of the tribe to replace Scarborough. And so it's well, I'm very interested that someone with translates well these two different well place. One is a Shikaro tribe in Taiwan, and one the Scarborough in English.
England.
So and then now was there some well some common image in between the two? Well,
amazing.
That's just a joke.
I'm just checking on my map where in England Scarborough is, because I believe it's coastal, just like the setting of this book. Yeah, it's the east coast of England in Yorkshire.
Yeah, Yorkshire. Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah. So just south of Whitby, where a lot of the book Dracula happens. So yeah, it's one of my mom's favorite songs, so I'll let her know to listen to this episode.
The Carlo.
And Dong Rong, did you have any song?
I think this Taiwan, a female singer from Taiwan, the Taiwan tribe, you know, the tribe in this novel, in this story, the main tribe. Her name is A Bao or A Nai Nai. And recently she had a song called Kinakayan, means mother's tongue. So in the past, Aboriginal singer was singing in Mandarin Chinese, but in recent years, recently, more and more indigenous singers would sing in their mother's language, mother tongue, in their tribal language. So this singer is now, she's very famous, A Bao, called mother tongue in English, but in Mandarin Chinese, Mu Qin De Shi Tou, means mother's tongue, mother's tongue. Sing it in her tribal language, but at the same time they but dancing about all this, because her mother complained that she cannot speak her tribal language very fluently. Always blamed or complains that so this singer now turned from Mandarin Chinese to her tribal language and to create this very popular, now very popular song called Mother Tongue or Mu Qin De Shi Tou. I would love to recommend listeners to listen to her singing of this song by her. Yeah, very talented, very beautiful singer. Okay.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I've got a link for that one. I made a note, so I'll make sure that goes into the show as well. Thank you very much. Okay, the next question. Now, this is the bonus question for Patreon. So listeners can support the show by signing up to this show's Patreon. It's patreon.com/trchfic. And then you get access to all the little bonus episodes and these bonus questions. So the bonus question is this? And it's a very wordy academic question, so you can answer it as sophisticatedly or as simply as you like. Do the forms of colonialism that feature in this book tend to be overlooked in favor of more large-scale and brutal examples? I suppose I'm more asking about in fiction and popular imagination, because I guess, Yao Chang, you didn't try to write a really sensational book, but you did really go into the details about the different colonial relationships. So, I'll wind up the bonus questions now, and I'll take us to the further reading, the final questions. So if listeners want more like Puppet Flower, where would you send them? I'll pass this one to Dong Rong because he's not spoken for a while.
Could you ask Dr. Chen to answer this question first?
Sure, I will. Yeah. So, Dr. Chen, if listeners wanted to enjoy more books like The Puppet Flower, what would you recommend them?
Well, I say there's a trilogy, and The Puppet Flower is the first one, and the second one is, you know, I just say it's Downhill Flower, and the third one is Bunker's Flower. And those three, actually I wrote those three fictions in the viewpoints of the Aborigines people and to what happened between hands. So I would like, nowadays we have translated, those two books are under translation, and hopefully when it comes through to be published in English version in about 2 or 3 years, hopefully.
Okay, good luck.
That's exactly my answer. Because there are other books might be available now, but the first three books I would recommend were written by Dr. Chen Yao Chang. So hopefully the English translation of Shi Tou Hua, the second one in the Flower Trilogy, the second one.
That's also translated by Dong Rong too.
I'm the translator, and hopefully it will be accepted by a press in UK or in the United States and published in due course. And also, actually, Dr. Chen also have a book already translated into English. It's called,
great.
A Tale of Three Tribes in Dutch Formosa.
The first book I mentioned.
It's going to be submitted to University Press for their review, and hopefully it will be coming out soon. So people interested in Taiwan history, people who love Dr. Chen's works, they will have opportunity to read the English version of another novel by Dr. Chen. And actually, Bangus, another novel in the so-called Flower Trilogy, already finished. It was translated into English already. And Dr. Chen Yao Chang is looking for a suitable publisher to publish this book. And for the listeners, if they are interested in Taiwan historic novels, they are of course there are others to read, and some written by the indigenous people themselves. Here I would like to mention a particular one is Sorceress Diguwa. It's published by the Serenity International in Taiwan. But another one that I would recommend is Remains of Life, a novel written by Wu He, and has been translated into English by Professor Michael Barry of UCLA. That will be also related to Taiwan's indigenous people. It already published. It's about the Wu She they so called Busha, Busha incident during the Japanese colonial period. Yeah, but I would strongly recommend it, readers or listeners to continue reading Dr. Chen's work when they are published in due course.
Yes, thank you.
Hopefully they will be published soon in the trilogy. There were already two novels. And prior to the trilogy, they have a tale, you know, of Formosa. Yeah, three tribes in Formosa, which was quite well translated. I mean, the translators of the novel is really have a very good command of English. I think he has done a wonderful job. Hopefully it will be published soon.
Okay, I'll be cheering you on. I hope we get all three. I'll drop in my own recommendation. It's an author that comes up a lot on the show. Maybe that just shows that my reading could be wider. I don't know. But the book is by an English author called David Mitchell. He does have a connection with East Asia. I've said this on the show a few times now, but he lived, I think he was an English teacher in Japan, married a Japanese lady, moved back to England. And his earlier, is it his earlier books? I'm not sure, but a couple of his books are actually set in Japan and follow this. Well, this one I'm about to mention, the main character is Dutch, because it's set in the Japanese, the Dutch trading post called Dejima. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Dejima.
In the harbor of Nagasaki. So a sort of floating trading point that was the only, at that time in history, that was the only place where foreigners, well, non-Japanese outsiders to Japan could have any contact with the Japanese.
Yeah.
And I'm just reading a description of the Wikipedia page, but the novel tells the story of a Dutch trader's love for a Japanese midwife who is spirited away into a sinister mountain temple cult. So there's a little bit more fantastical elements than in Puppet Flower, but to be honest, they're very subtle and at the edges of the book. It sort of reads as a similar thing where David Mitchell has invented some characters, popped them into a real historical setting. And I suppose a big difference is the drama in that story is not really about real political events. Maybe there are some going on. It's more about a particular plot he's invented. But the sense of realism and the sort of the connection with the Dutch, the historical timing, it's not so different. So I think if a reader had read that, they'd enjoy Puppet Flower, and probably vice versa. I guess another big parallel is the cultural crossovers that happen. In, I guess, in Puppet Flower, you mostly see characters who are very good at understanding how to negotiate the cultural differences, I guess, because a lot of the Hakka, Hokkien, and Aboriginal people have a really good understanding of how to do that. We do see that when the Americans come in, that they're sort of idiots. They think they can just crush the locals. And in Thousand Autumns, you meet some Dutch characters and some Japanese characters who know how to navigate the cultural differences. But we have some, I don't remember if we have any Japanese characters who hate the foreigners, quite possibly. But what sticks in my memory is that there are some Dutch characters who are just real bastards, and they're basically just racist in their views towards the Japanese. And yet there they are conducting their colonial business. So there's that side to it too. I've only read it once. I really enjoyed it, so I recommend it to the listeners. That's enough there. I've talked for far too long about that book. Not much else for me to do now, apart from to end the interview. Before I say goodbye, is there anything we've not touched on either of you would like to say?
No. One supplement. You know the term Formosa is prohibited by PRC.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's my final comment.
Okay. Good note to end on. Right. So thank you both very much for your time. Thanks for talking about the book, teaching me a few things along the way. Just thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Our pleasure. Yeah.
All right, that's the end of the episode. As always, big thank you to the guests, Mr. Chen and Mr. Chen. the author and one of the three translators. Fantastic to have you. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the episode. I don't think I've got anything very flowery, no pun intended, to say. Maybe just that we're on episode 96 now, we're getting near the end. Am I emotional? Not really. I'm not really feeling emotional. Maybe I will when it is actually hiatus time. But yeah, until then, if you've got thoughts on this episode, or indeed any past episodes you've listened to and want to share them by whatever means, then the social media is all in the show notes. But if you want to get it through your ear hole, here you go. The show has an Instagram. It's at Churchific, TRCHFIC. There's a Discord. There's an invite link in the show notes. I can't really direct you to that one. I am on Twitter for general purposes and for promoting this show. That's at Angus Likes Words. Nothing much else to say. But if you'd like to support the show, help cover the hosting fees, which I'm gonna keep the hosting going after the show goes on hiatus. Although I'll pause the Patreon payment collections because I think that would be a bit too cheeky to keep that going. If you wanna support the show, there are support links on the website and in the show notes. There's a buy me a coffee. That's a way to make a one-off contribution. So I would say, if you want to help cover show hosting after the show goes on hiatus, go there, because the Patreon won't really. I don't know. What am I gonna do? Am I gonna pause it? I don't know what I'll do with the Patreon. But if you wanna sign up to the Patreon before the show goes on hiatus, then that's patreon.com/churchific, TRCHFIC. There's a gazillion, not a gazillion, but there's an awful lot of free episodes. A lot of them are me speaking solo, rambling like a maniac, like I am right now, about things I've read that may have been covered on the show or may not quite have qualified for the show, or maybe they got covered on the show long after I did a Patreon monologue about them. And obviously all the bonus question answers are in there too, so you can sign up for that as well. And of course, the best thing you can do for the show, you probably know by now, it's to tell other human beings. So tell your friend, tell your teacher, tell the captain of your colonial vessel, tell your tribal chief, and most importantly, tell your interpreter, because I don't know if the role of interpreters came up in the discussion about this book. I don't think they did, but it's quite important in Puppet Flower and important to the world, really, the interpreters. So just a big round of applause for all the interpreters out there. I think you guys deserve it. And translators, actually, but I feel like you guys already get a lot of love on the show. So actually, no, the applause is only for interpreters. I hope it means something to you if you're listening, and if it doesn't, you know, just appreciate that it meant something to someone else. So applause over, all my monologue, it's over. Now is the time to say zaijian.